been searching for that time to get on some sort of a roll here to get that good feeling, and you need a game like this to give you a chance.
We're still struggling to try and score goals night in and night out, but we've been able to do that in the last couple games.
It doesn't get any easier as the season moves on. Road games get tougher and tougher.
There's not an easy answer to that.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Ezra, Dave, and Drew on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at tsn1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Dave Minuke, Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. Gentlemen, we're going to get right into it with the Jets talk. Of course, the draft lottery goes later on this evening. The Jets with a 2.705% chance to jump up from their current space in 12th to one of the top three picks, which are all, of course, based in the lottery. Could they replicate the success of last year's draft lottery that saw them draft Patrick Laine? Not really going to ask you guys your thoughts about it because obviously it's a random lottery, but it is it's an important day for the team in that they will know where they will draft come end of June in Chicago. Is there a possibility they get into the top three? You'll know very early. You know very early when you're watching the draft lottery, because if the Jets card isn't there when number 12 comes along, or if it's not there in the first few cards that are revealed, you know that the Jets have done something extremely unlikely in this draft lottery. But it is a day that will provide some certainty for the team going forward as it relates to the NHL draft.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Drew, there's a 76 or 78% chance that the Jets draft 12th overall, but I mean, 2.7% chance of them drafting first overall or 2.8% chance of them drafting second overall. You're saying there's a chance, right? So right. If you're a Jets fan, I mean, there's still reason to watch. And you're going to find out who's going to get the first overall pick. Is it going to be Colorado or Vancouver? Or maybe it's going to be Arizona, Vegas.
Maybe Vegas. Maybe Vegas gets a big boost to their chances. It's the Nico versus Nolan draft. That has been what's become perfectly clear is that there certainly is a top two, and that's Nolan Patrick down the road in Brandon playing for the Wheat Kings. A down season for him as he was injury-riddled throughout the course of the season.
Yeah, but you know what, Drew? He's still the number one consensus pick. I don't think this is like 2009 Taylor versus Tyler or anything like that. I think we're all expecting Nolan Patrick to go first overall, and that's not taking anything away from Nico Hischier. He's a really good player for the Halifax Mooseheads in the QMJHL, but I think even though Nolan Patrick missed a lot of hockey this year, I mean, you listen to Craig Button talk about Nolan Patrick. We've had him on the show this year. We're going to have him on, obviously, closer to the NHL draft, but I think we'd all be surprised if it isn't Nolan Patrick first overall.
Well, if you read Bob McKenzie's latest article regarding the NHL draft, I mean, for the entire season, it was Nolan Patrick ahead of Nico Hischier. No question about that. But then in his latest article that came out, I believe, Thursday on TSN.ca, he went to 21 different scouts in the NHL, 21 different general managers in the NHL, and it was only 12 in favor of Nolan Patrick, 11 in favor of Nico Hischier. So
the gap is for sure closed.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were talking about this 6 months ago or even 3 or 4 months ago, Drew, the gap probably wasn't as small as it is now. So, I mean, I guess there is that chance that Nolan Patrick doesn't go first overall. You remember back to 2013 when Nathan MacKinnon was drafted first overall. Mm-hmm. There was a possibility that Seth Jones was going to go first overall, and he fell to number 4.
That's right.
I think there are some similarities between this year's draft and 2013.
I would agree with you, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I would still expect Nolan Patrick is going to get the first overall pick, but it's much closer now than it has been at any point in time.
And Nico Hischier absolutely tore up the World Juniors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that NHL teams base their picks on the World Juniors, Dave, but certainly a standout performance like that only helped his stock.
Yeah, and I think also for, you know, Nolan Patrick's situation, he's not a guy who's coming in and saving a team. And, you know, like the Vikings GM, Grant Armstrong, was talking, and he was talking about the type of player he'll be. And he said he's going to be a top six, but he's going to take time. He's going to need time to develop. So, and especially in light of the fact that he had so many injuries this season and he was out for so long, this isn't a guy who's going to come in next season and save the Colorado Avalanche or save some team that manages a chance, you know, gets the opportunity to draft him. So, you know, that's why you're always thinking to yourself, there is a chance that somebody else comes in if, you know, like a Hischier, and he's sitting there and he goes, maybe he is going to be able to help your team have a bigger impact right away. I mean, that's the only way you kind of look at it, is that maybe if you're a team that needs some sort of shot in the arm, mm-hmm. you go set them in that manner as opposed to someone who may take a few more years to develop.
Well, I think the overwhelming takeaway so far is that this isn't a generational draft.
Right.
This isn't like it has been for the last couple of years where Austin Matthews and Patrick Laine last year are generational players who are going to immediately step in, immediately contribute to a team, and possibly change the fortunes of a team for the next decade.
Well,
it's not. There's no Connor McDavid. There's no Jack Eichel in this draft. It is a draft that is a step below the complete elite of recent drafts.
Yeah, and we've seen that before. And you know, we go to the draft every year, and we've heard talk, because you know you're kind of mixed in, you mix and mingle with, you know, scouts and management and media, and you listen to these guys talk, and it's ironic to be at a current draft and they're already looking ahead at the next draft.
Mm-hmm.
Because in, I think it was 2014, it was a lighter draft, and so you're sitting there going, they're already so excited about 2015. So they were talking about 2015, we were at 2014 draft, and that was
What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, no, and honestly, and you're just sitting there and you're like, it's hilarious, because you're like, we're on a bus driving to the draft. I think it was for the Saturday of the draft, and we're sitting amongst these guys, and they're like, wow, I'm so excited for, you know, and nobody wants to reveal anything. So they talk in like, you know, oh, there's a number of A-plus guys, or, you know, and then in 2014, there weren't any A-plus.
Right.
But in 2015, there were obviously a couple of A-pluses.
Some guy named McDavid, guy named Michael.
Exactly. So that's the whole point, is that you have these guys already looking ahead. This is one of those drafts, I would suspect, is similar in nature to 2014.
And, Dave, what I think is going to be so interesting about this year's draft is the Jets have never traded away their number one pick, right?
Yes.
And last year, you saw the Jets trade up to draft Logan Stanley with their second first-round pick. And, you know, he went, I believe it was 17th overall, 18th overall. And this year, you have the strong possibility that the Jets will trade that first round pick, just because, you know, the Jets are in the market for both a goaltender and a defenseman. So I think that's what's so fascinating about this year's draft. Are the Jets going to get the second overall pick again, or the first overall pick? Most likely not, because their chances are so low this year.
Mm-hmm.
They're most likely going to pick 12th overall, just based on the odds. But you wonder if they move that pick to get that sought-after defenseman.
I don't know. As I ran the draft simulator a couple of times yesterday, and I suspect that the site isn't getting nearly the hits it had last year when everyone was so excited about it. But I did get the Jets in the second spot a couple of times. So.
Well, then that's got to be what's going to happen.
You know, but of course there were also about 300 other times where they didn't get it. So,
well, the Jets can draft anywhere from first, second, or third,
because
of course the lottery is for the top three places,
right,
to 12th, 13th, 14th, or 15th.
The likelihood is 12th or 13th.
The likelihood is 12th and 13th.
If you look at the rankings, Drew, I don't think it really matters if you draft 12th, 13th, 14th, or 15th, right? Because it's not like, you know, the list of players what separates the players at that point is that much, right? It's definitely more so at the top. I think there's a big drop-off after Nolan Patrick and after Nico Hischier, right? It's going to be a Gabe Vilardi or another prospect at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right now, the odds are not good. It's not like last year. But again, it didn't look like the Jets were going to get the second overall pick last year, and they did, right?
Well, if you look at Bob McKenzie's most recent article, I mean, Timothy Liljegren was supposed to be the guy who was the number three in this draft. For the longest time, everyone thought he was the third best prospect. Well, he's another guy who had a very difficult year. He had injuries. I believe he had mononucleosis at earlier in the season. So he's a guy who's seen his stock drop from top three, top four, to that mid-teens where the Jets would be drafting, 12, 13, 14.
Doesn't that remind you of Jacob Chychrun?
Sure, exactly. Same thing with last year with Jacob Trickren, who eventually ends up with the Arizona Coyotes after he saw his stock drop throughout the course of the season. So it is certainly interesting. I mean, there's quality players. It's not, they don't have the same ceiling that they've had in previous years, but they say it's an inexact science, and it certainly is. But to your point before, Ezzy, and I think that there's a greater chance this year than any other year of the Jets, in fact, trading this pick, because you mentioned the holes that they need to fill, be it on the left side of the defense, be it with a veteran goaltender. But this year, it seems to me, just as an outsider's observer, this would be the year of, if any, for the Jets to trade that first round pick.
I agree with that, Drew. But you know, if you're a Jets fan and you're not that happy if they get the 12th pick or the 13th pick, I mean, the Jets' track record at the draft is excellent, right? You got Josh Morrissey mm-hmm. at 13th overall. You got Jacob Trouba at 9th overall. You got Nikolai Ehlers at 9th overall. So just because you're not picking in the top 5 or the top 7 doesn't mean that you're not going to get an excellent player, right? So again, this isn't as good of a draft as the 2015 draft or the 2016 draft or even that 2011 draft. If you go back and look at that 2011 draft, you had Johnny Gaudreau and Nikita Kucherov taken very late in that draft, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, but when you're talking about possibly trading that first-round pick, I mean, we know how coveted those first-round picks are. And if the Jets are looking for a top-4 left-side defenseman, which we think they are, why not possibly move that first-round pick?
That absolutely would be the case. Moving away from the draft quickly, there was a trade last night in the NHL that is of relevance to some Jets fans. They thought this goaltender might be a target for the Winnipeg Jets come unrestricted free agency. That is Scott Darling of the Chicago Blackhawks. He gets dealt from the Blackhawks to the Carolina Hurricanes in exchange for a third-round pick. Basically, the Hurricanes are acquiring the right to negotiate with him from now through July 1st to see if they can get him under contract, make him the quote-unquote goaltender of the future in Carolina. Cam Ward certainly towards the end of his career. Eddie Lack did not work out in Carolina. He's on his way out there. So the Hurricanes acquire Scott Darling for a third-round pick and will probably do their damnedest to sign him to a contract extension.
Yeah, and I believe Eddie Lack still has a year left on his contract, and he's going to be the goalie that they expose in the expansion draft, unless I'm wrong about that. But the Twitterverse was a little bit confused yesterday because they thought that teams weren't allowed to make trades. But teams that aren't in the playoffs can actually make trades. That's always been the rule. And obviously, Scott Darling was one of those goaltenders that was going to be sought after as an unrestricted free agent. He's done a nice job there backing up Corey Crawford. So as you said, Drew, really, the Carolina Hurricanes are just getting a head start on negotiating with him before July 1.
Yeah, an interesting move, though, an interesting tactic. They obviously identified Darling as a guy that they think can be a number one goaltender.
It's a smart
in this
trade
league.
By Francis. It really is.
I think it's a smart trade by Chicago, too. They get a third-round pick for a guy they weren't going to bring back.
Sure.
I mean, I think it's a smart trade for Ron Francis as long as he signs him.
No, I think you have to take that risk. I mean, the whole point is that, you know, if you targeted Darling as a potential goalie that you could see, especially with that decor in Carolina, if he could potentially be the guy, then you have to take that chance because then you're not competing against all these other teams that are clearly in the market for another goaltender. So, I mean, you know, sure, an asset is an asset, but I mean, right now in Carolina, you know, maybe a goaltender gets you into the playoffs versus not having that goaltender who's, you know, because they clearly didn't have a lot of faith in Eddie Lack.
No,
so,
especially after Bill Peters sort of threw him under the bus later in the year.
And then he kind of responded, but still, it doesn't matter. The reality is that, you know, that relationship at that point is damaged.
I was going to say, Drew, that reminded me of back in 2012 when the Boston Bruins signed Marty Turco after the NHL trade deadline. He was actually retired at that point. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he couldn't play in the playoffs that year.
That you can sign a player to finish the regular season, but after the trade deadline, if they're not on your roster, they're not playoff eligible.
Right.
Yeah, so that's why a guy like Vladimir Sobotka
yep.
of the St. Louis Blues, he was on the Blues roster. So he was playoff eligible, even though he played most of the season in the KHL. He's a guy who still belonged to the Blues. He was still their property. It just getting him into the roster at a later date.
And Sabatka's been excellent.
He's been terrific.
He was great last night. He was good in the first round. And, you know, this is one of those moves again. Yeah, obviously, if the Carolina Hurricanes don't sign Scott Darling, you give up that third round pick. But there's a good chance he signs.
I would think he would sign. And if you're this, if you're the Carolina Hurricanes, and so you've acquired him for a third round pick, and you're going to negotiate with him for the next, let's say, month and 6 weeks or whatever it might be, and if things don't work out and you can't get under a contract, there's nothing to preclude you from trading his rights to another team that might want to get a head start on talking to Scott Darling.
Well, why wouldn't Scott Darling want to sign guys? You're going to a team that has a lot of promising young talent, right? You're talking about Victor Rask and Sebastian Aho, Noah Hanifin, Hayden Fleury, Jake Bean. They've got a lot of good young D prospects there. And Cam Ward's an older goaltender. Mm-hmm. So there's an opportunity for Scott Darling to eventually become the number one goaltender. So, again, you know, just getting a head start on free agency there.
Let me ask, should Kevin Cheveldayoff off consider a move like this if he identifies a goaltender that's a pending unrestricted free agent?
Yeah, why not?
Should he make a move like that?
Yeah, I wouldn't have any problem with that, especially if you've identified, as you said, the goaltender that you want, and if it requires trading a draft pick to get him, then do it, right? Because as we know, I mean, Ben Bishop is going to be very sought after as far as unrestricted free agent goalies go, and there's going to be a lot of interest in Marc-Andre Fleury, right? He's got that no-movement clause.
If he chooses to waive it, of course.
Exactly, and yeah. We expect him to waive it because the Penguins, we think, are going to want to protect Matt Murray. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, after Marc-Andre Fleury and Ben Bishop, you know, there are only so many number one goalies out there available, right?
I don't know if they're going to want to give Marc-Andre Fleury the way he's playing right now.
Yeah, well, it was certainly a stroke of genius by Jim Rutherford to not trade.
I mean, it's funny because we talk about it. I mean, not that we're exclusively talking, but I'm sure everybody was talking about how this could potentially happen. Yeah. And if you don't have Marc-Andre Fleury as your backup, what happens to your team?
Well, right now the Penguins wouldn't be in the playoffs. Yeah. If Matt Murray goes out in the warm-up of game one, and if Marc-Andre Fleury wasn't there to back him up, it's hard to believe that they would have been able to get by the Blue Jackets, at least as easily as they did.
Yep, exactly.
When we come back, we'll look at the Ducks and the Oilers. The Oilers go into Anaheim. They steal the first two games of the series. We talk about that playoff series next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca. Here's Everly, walks in to the front of the net, score! Tipped in by Patrick Maroon! A power play goal and Edmonton's out front 2-0.
That proved to be the game-winning goal. Patrick Maroon, his second of the playoffs at 6:41 of the second period. The Oilers defeat the Ducks by a 2-1 margin, win both games in Anaheim, take a 2-0 series lead. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information, visit lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. The irony of Patrick Maroon getting the game-winning goal last night for the Oilers is, of course, that the Ducks are still paying a significant part of his salary. So that's really upsetting, probably, from the Anaheim Ducks perspective.
Is that irony?
It's definitely a bit ironic.
It's a bit ironic that a guy you're paying to not play for your team comes back to bite your team in the butt. That's a little bit of irony.
No, I wasn't being sarcastic. I really want to know what irony means.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I didn't think you were being sarcastic. But I think it's a little bit. I mean, it's not completely ironic. It's not Alanis Morissette ironic. It's just
Rain on your wedding day, right,
yeah,
Drew?
Right. Your wedding is going to rain on your wedding day. It's coming up.
Be careful, Ezzy. Be careful what you wish for.
How was the Fire Festival, by the way?
What's the Fire Festival?
Fry Festival?
I have no idea.
I thought it was the Fire Festival.
Drew, what are you talking about right now?
The one in the Bahamas.
Well, Drew is part of an exclusive crew of people who paid $12,000 to fly down to the Bahamas for an EDM show that didn't take place.
That's right. It wasn't EDM, though.
No, it was like Blink-182.
Blink-182 was the headlining act.
And then they pulled out.
And then everybody pulled out. You missed that entirely yesterday, Ez?
What does that have to do with my wedding?
Nothing. I was just asking you.
That was a bit of a jump.
It was a bit of a jump, but it was a humorous jump, implying that you're an Instagram celebrity.
Let's move it along.
Drew, let's get to the Ducks-Oilers series here.
Okay, fair enough. So anyways, regardless if it's ironic or not, Patrick Maroon scored the game-winning goal last night. The Oilers, to the surprise of, well, certainly me, take both games in Anaheim, take a stranglehold on the series, and head back to Edmonton, really, with the series in their hands.
And I think it's so surprising because Connor McDavid only has one assist in the first two games, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are other players on this Oilers team that can score, Drew, but, I mean, let's be honest here. I mean, Anaheim did not play very well in game one, but last night in Anaheim, the Ducks absolutely dominated the Oilers. The only period that I thought was even was the second period. And the Oilers obviously score on the first shot of the game, and they get the early lead, and they eventually get a 2-0 lead early in the second period. But in that third period, it was all Anaheim Ducks. And even in the first period, Cam Talbot, if you watch that game, makes an absolutely beautiful save on Ryan Getzlaff. He makes a big save on Ryan Kessler. And sure, the Anaheim Ducks, when they're pushing for that tying goal, Cam Fowler hits the crossbar there in the third period. So, you know, they got a bit of unfortunate luck there, or bad luck. But this was all Cam Talbot, right? Mm-hmm. He makes 39 of 40 saves. He was the biggest difference in that series against the San Jose Sharks, especially early on in the series when he was getting those shutouts, Drew. So, I mean, this is a game that Cam Talbot absolutely stole. And if you were listening to the Oilers after the game, whether it was Connor McDavid or Patrick Maroon, they were basically saying the same, that Cam Talbot really was the difference in that game. So give them a lot of credit, because whether you look at the shot totals or the faceoff totals, Ryan Kessler and Ryan Getzlaff were dominating that faceoff circle. I think they combined to go 62 or 63%. And we already knew that they were good faceoff guys, but the possession battle was completely dominated by the Anaheim Ducks last night. But Cam Talbot, as he's done all year long, stood on his head and won them that game.
And I think the key for Edmonton was the fast start. Sakura gets that goal a minute, 5 seconds into the game. And if you watch the play, everybody was focused on Connor McDavid, who went deep, and they were kind of standing around watching him. The puck gets, you know, pushed out to Sekera, who blasts it home, and already it's 1-0 into the game. And, you know, if you're Anaheim, now you've got to play from behind. You're already feeling, you know, like the Oilers have the series lead, so you've got to, like, push it a little bit, trying to get that equalizer to kind of get your crowd, you know, the home crowd into it, because that just kills a building, right? You know, or a goal. We've seen a lot of those here at the MTS Center, mm-hmm. and we know what it's like. You know, it can just destroy a home crowd. So that was a critical play for the Oilers to kind of take the momentum from that game in and the crowd specifically out of it. And then Maroon gets that second goal, and suddenly now you're really trying to push. And Silverberg scored a beauty on the power play. I mean, that was just an absolute spectacular. Like, Talbot had no chance. He was getting screened in front, I think, by Eves, but I'm not sure. And it was just like a gorgeous goal. And then, you know, the truth is also, Talbot played a phenomenal game, but puck luck does factor in. I mean, as he talked about, you know, the Getzlaff hit the crossbar. Eves redirected a shot in front that also beat Talbot clean and then went off the post, or maybe he actually caught a little bit of Talbot's pad and then hit the post. So, I mean, Anaheim, as he talked about, was dominant. I mean, they had so many shots on net, and they just couldn't beat Talbot, or they couldn't beat the post, and, you know, in the end, Edmonton takes the game.
And a game like last night where Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl maybe didn't have their best games, mm-hmm. I mean, different heroes emerged. Todd McClellan talked about it, right? And now through two rounds, and it's early in the second round, the Oilers have had 11 different goal scorers, right? So, I mean, they're getting balanced scoring. In game one, it was Leon Draisaitl and Mark Letestu,
sure,
who's emerged as kind of a power play specialist for them. And you're seeing balanced scoring throughout the lineup. And the Oilers right now, I mean, they are definitely going to have to correct a few things in game three. They're giving up way too many high-quality scoring chances. They just are. You can't give up that many scoring chances against the Anaheim Ducks. And, you know, the next game is tomorrow afternoon, I believe. And when you talk about this Anaheim Ducks team, you go down 3-0 in Edmonton, series is over, if it's not already over. I mean, it's going to be very hard for them to come back, right? They've got to win 4 of the next 5 games. And the way this Oilers team is playing offensively, if Connor McDavid gets going in Edmonton, I mean, this series could be over in 4 or 5 games.
Well, now you'll see that Randy Carlyle won't be able to line match as easily because they won't have line last change. So McDavid will be able to get a little bit away from Kessler.
Well, although, funny you mentioned that, right? Because last night, yeah, it was more so Ryan Getzlaff's line,
that's right,
against Connor McDavid's line, as opposed to game one,
which was
when
Kessler.
It was all Kessler all over Connor McDavid.
McDavid,
right?
Was better last night than he was in game one.
Well, in that first period, I mean, the way he uses his speed, we know he's one of the fastest guys in the NHL, right?
Yeah.
But on that goal that was scored by Andre Sekera, McDavid doesn't get credit for the assist, but it was his speed that really led to the goal.
But that's a bad goal. That goal should never go in. Short side from the point. I mean, John Gibson, you know, Dave said, you know, Dave talked about the start to the game. This is a goaltender who didn't have a great game one, gives up a weak goal to be down 1-0. The second goal, fine, nothing you can really complain about on that second goal. But all of a sudden, you have a Ducks team that's eventually down 2 goals, going up against a guy like Cam Talbot, who's certainly playing with just the utmost of confidence. The puck looks like a beach ball to him right now. That's a save that John Gibson has to make right off the start. And, you know, the Ducks had a little bit of gamesmanship during the warm-up. Jonathan Bernier was first off the ice for the Ducks in the pregame warm-up, leading some to speculate that he was actually going to get the start for the Ducks. Carlisle ended up going with Gibson, and Gibson lets in that softy to start the game, and all of a sudden the Ducks are pressing again. It's a different Ducks team when they're trying to, you know, choke the life out of a team when they have the lead. They haven't had a lead at all during this series.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, Corey Perry was pretty invisible the first 2 games in Anaheim. Yeah. He's got to step up. He was pretty good in the first round against Calgary. A guy like Antoine Vermette struggled a lot. So, I mean, Corey Perry is not on the top line anymore. He's playing on that third line. And
Nick Ritchie's absence from the lineup last night had something to do with that.
Yeah, and that's why Jared Boll was in the lineup.
Right.
So the veteran depth players on this team are going to have to step up, because Ryan Getzlaff, we talked about Jakob Silverberg, Rickard Rakell, I mean, they've been pretty good, but when those guys aren't scoring, you need to get it from other sources, and that's what the Oilers have been able to do, and that's what teams that go far in the playoffs do.
Would you consider going with Bernier over Gibson in Game 3? Game 3 is actually tomorrow night, for the record. It's a night game in Edmonton tomorrow night. Would you consider going with Bernier over Gibson?
I think the reason I thought that is because it's an early start.
Yeah, it's a 6 o'clock. It's a 6 o'clock Winnipeg start in Edmonton, which means it's a 5 o'clock start in Edmonton tomorrow.
So that's the afternoon, technically.
Technically, you're fine. It's not the afternoon game on NBC though. That's St. Louis, Nashville. And back to my original question: would you go with Bernier over Gibson at this point?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, John Gibson, you mentioned. I mean, he didn't have his best game last night in Anaheim, but I think at this point, I mean, John Gibson is your number one goalie, and you know, Jonathan Bernier had a good season as well. But I think at this point, you don't go with Jonathan Bernier. But I mean, let's be honest, Randy Carlisle is a veteran coach who is not afraid to switch goaltenders at this point in the season. So there always is the chance we see Bernier in Game 3.
Well, of the 16 goalies who've really played the majority of games, I'm not counting guys like Chad Johnson, who played, you know, a cup of coffee in a game, you know, in the first round of the playoffs. Gibson's at the bottom there, or 13th rather. He's got a 2.76 goals against average and a .915 save percentage. The only people that were worse than him in the first round were Elliott, Bobrovsky, and Crawford. So John Gibson hasn't been giving the Ducks what I would describe as stellar goaltending. It didn't matter in round one. It's beginning to affect them a bit in round two.
I would suspect he has a short leash in Edmonton, though. I mean, like, if there's something of a soft goal, then he's gone, would be my guess. Because the point is that Randy Carlisle knows that his team, it's like any situation. I mean, Gibson's still a very young goaltender. And the fact of the matter is that you can't afford to have a veteran team like Anaheim just lose faith in the back end, because it's not going to be helpful for the way they attack the Oilers. So I think if you see an early goal like we did yesterday, then you'll see Gibson pulled in favor of Bernier.
And Dave, he let in 2 goals yesterday, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But he only made 21 saves.
Most of the
saves.
Time, that's enough to give your team a chance to win. And
Fair. It
just happens that Cam Talbot makes 39 saves and is the first star of the game, right? So, again, I mean, we'll see what Randy Carlisle decides to do. But I'd agree with Dave. I would expect Gibson to start. And if he falters early, then maybe Bernier comes in.
Up next, Jonas Siegel joins us from Ottawa. We're going to go around the NHL playoffs with the senior hockey writer for the Canadian Press. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 12. 90.
Brad, Dave, and Drew return on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
It's Saturday morning on TSN 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend Jonas Siegel. Jonas covers the NHL for the Canadian Press. He joins us live from Ottawa, where he's there for Game 2 of the Sens and the Rangers. Jonas, good morning, and thanks for doing this.
Hey, no problem. How's it going, guys?
Doing very well, Jonas. Thanks for joining us, as I mentioned. You're in Ottawa for Game 2 of the Senators and the Rangers. We will obviously, might as well start with that series, but we'll whip our way around the league in its entirety. Game 1, of course, was a close game until Erik Karlsson broke the tie with that bad angle goal late in the third period. Less so about the Game 1, though. Is this series in its entirety hasn't seemed to really capture the imagination of the hockey world. Is that have more to do with the fact it's up against, you know, Crosby and Ovechkin and the Penguins and the Capitals taking place on the other side of the bracket in the Eastern Conference?
I think that's probably part of it. I think you've got McDavid on the other side. You know, that's a bit more intriguing. And I think you just have the realization that these are two not great teams. These are two not super exciting teams. Obviously, the Rangers like to play fast, but, you know, Henrik Lundqvist is coming off his worst season in the NHL. He's been terrific in the playoffs. There's just not that much sexiness about this series. It's not like you've got, you know, this matchup between two clubs that have this bitter history against one another. There's just two teams that you look at that are okay, you know, that will probably lose to either Washington or Pittsburgh in the second round, and that'll be it. You know, we're not looking at either the Senators or Rangers as cup contenders, and I think that kind of takes away from the series a little bit, but you still have, you know, intriguing aspects of the series. You know, Erik Karlsson's playing at a level that I don't think we've seen from him before. You know, he just keeps getting better. He's coming off a season that should win him the Norris Trophy. So there are intriguing aspects of the series, and the fact that Henrik Lundqvist is back kind of playing like a Hall of Famer is fun to watch, but I get it. You know, I get why it lacks the appeal of Crosby, Ovechkin, or, you know, McDavid kind of taking Edmonton on a postseason ride for the first time in, you know, a decade.
Jonas, we have to ask you about the elephant in the arena, and that is the empty seats at Air Canada Center. Canadian Tire Center. How concerned do you think Ottawa Senators owner Eugene Melnyk is with the empty seats?
I'm sure he has to be growing in concern, because this is not a new thing. This has been going on all year, and I think it's funny. Like, you look at attendance for Ottawa the past couple years. Last year it was good. You know, I think it was 94-95% capacity. Same thing the year before. But this year it's really dropped off. Like, they didn't sell out their home opener against the Maple Leafs. Like, that was Austin Matthews' NHL debut. It's a rival. An Ontario rival, that didn't sell out. It actually took them until, I think it was December 29th, when they retired Daniel Alfredson's jersey, for them to sell out. That was the biggest crowd of the year. So this has been an issue all season long. I think they were at 87% capacity for the regular season, which is tied for 24th in the NHL. And you'd expect, you know, once you get to the playoffs, you're one of two Canadian teams left in the second round, that people would come. But they haven't. You know, there were, as you mentioned, there were a ton of empty seats there the other night. And you talk to people around Ottawa, and it seems to be a lot of different things. It's prices. You know, I think the cheapest seat for Game 1 was $88. They raised the ticket prices, or the parking prices, from $20 to $30. So all these things add up. And, you know, it's out in Kanata. You know, people don't love Eugene Melnyk. Like, there's a lot of factors, I think, that go into this. And I think it certainly, you know, has to be of some concern for the Senators, because it's been going on for a bit now.
Jonas, we were talking about the greatness of Erik Karlsson. And one of the things I was surprised about, and I think a lot of people were, is that he disclosed the nature of his injury between round one and round two. And if this is Erik Karlsson playing through an injury, how impressive is that, considering how well he's played throughout this series?
It just adds to the drama and kind of the appeal of what he's done. You know, in the first round, you know, he's averaging 30 minutes a game. And you mentioned the injury. I think it was two hairline fractures in his left foot. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't sound like it's something that would be easy to play with, especially for a guy who so relies upon his ability to skate and do things that way. But he's just making plays. And from watching Erik Karlsson, you know, I took a trip out here mid-March to do a story on Karlsson and to dig into Guy Boucher's effect with the Senators. And what's funny, when you watch Karlsson closely, it's a lot of, like, the little plays he makes. It's not, you know, obviously the goal the other night and plays like that, you know, kind of catch your attention when he makes a you know, a highlight reel worthy play to create a goal. That's impressive. But it's like the little things that he does to help his team get out of the defensive zone. It's like the little passes he makes, the way he angles off, you know, forwards to get a puck out. It's really impressive if you watch him just up close how good he is. You know, Guy Boucher said in March that he should be considered for the Hart Trophy, not just the Norris. And it's hard to disagree given all that he does. Like, take away Erik Karlsson from the Ottawa Senators, and what are they? Like, I don't know.
They're not a playoff team, that's for sure.
They're not a playoff team, yeah. Right? Like, he's playing half the game. He's at a point per game in the playoffs. Possession numbers are terrific. He's every bit the star that people say he is. You know, and it's especially apparent when you're up close.
Jonas Siegel, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Jonas covers the NHL for the Canadian Press. Jonas, moving away from the Sens and the Rangers to the Ducks and the Oilers. They had their game two last night in Anaheim. How surprised are you to see the Oilers go into Anaheim, win the first two games of the series, and really take a stranglehold on that divisional final? Pardon me.
I'm surprised. I thought the Ducks are considerably better than Edmonton. I think they're deeper everywhere. I think they're deeper up front. I think they're deeper on defense. I would say the one edge, you know, that Edmonton has in terms of big picture lineup is in goal. Cam Talbot, you know, was my third pick, I think, we don't get to vote on the Vezina, but I did a fake awards column and gave him my third vote. But I'm surprised because I just thought Anaheim was the better team. And I think you look at the first two games and Anaheim has been the better team, but they've lost both games. You know, you look at game one, they dominate possession. Edmonton, you know, scores with a couple power plays. Dreisaitl has 4 points, and they lose that game. John Gibson doesn't have a great night. And then you look last night the way it started. You know, Gibson gives up a goal early. They're behind. They kind of change their tactics a little bit, seemingly, against Connor McDavid. And they drop that game despite completely owning the third period. So as much as I think we look at the series now and say, you know, Edmonton is in the driver's seat, and they are, I still think Anaheim is going to be the team that prevails in the series. They've just played better by a wide margin in the first two games, and I don't think Edmonton is deep enough to keep up. You know, but outside of that line with, you know, McDavid and Dreisaitl, there's just not a lot cooking there for the Oilers. And I think at some point, if, you know, barring John Gibson, you know, not improving, the Ducks will eventually come back and make this a series.
Jonas, just going back to last week, I know you wrote about it a lot for the Canadian press. Just how amazing was that Leafs-Capitals series to watch, and how much do you think that's going to help the Capitals in their second-round series against the Pens? They're already down 1-0.
I think it'll probably help them in that they got their scare. You know, they were in danger of losing that series. You know, they wasn't like this thing where this young team, you know, kind of threatens a little bit but isn't really that close. All six games were decided by a goal. All six games were close. All six games probably could have been won by either team. And, you know, Washington was coming into the postseason with all this pressure. You know, they're a team that basically, if they're not winning it this year, they're not winning it. You know, there's a bunch of free agents on their roster. Justin Williams, TJ Oshie, Carl Alsner, Kevin Shattenkirk. Like, this team is not going to be the same next year, and they know that. They know that this is their, you know, window to win. And so you kind of get a scare in the first round where you're tested against a young team that doesn't have much to lose, and now you face the team that you kind of have to overcome to get to the Eastern Conference Final and then presumably get to the Stanley Cup Final. So I think it'll benefit them. I picked Pittsburgh to win this series, and I still think they'll probably win this series, but we'll see how Washington responds, because, you know, they got a threat from Toronto and they eventually kind of found their way in winning the last three games. And, you know, it's possible they'll make this tight with Pittsburgh.
Well, Jonas, speaking of the recently departed Toronto Maple Leafs and their coach, specifically Mike Babcock, you made the case for him potentially winning his first Jack Adams, which to me is shocking that he's never won one considering his history of winning in this league. Why do you think it is that he has a chance to win the Jack Adams this season?
Well, it's a lot of reasons. It's primarily the big thing is how many young players they dressed, and it's not like they just put them in the lineup and use them in depth roles. They were using, you know, seven rookies every night, sometimes nine, and they were playing major roles. You know, Nikita Zaitsev led the team in minutes. He was a rookie. Austin Matthews led the forwards in minutes. He was a rookie. Most of their penalty kill was rookies, and their penalty kill was top 10 in the NHL. They were using these guys and exposing them to difficult duties right away. And I think that that was in part Mike Babcock. He realized early in the season that these guys were good. You know, it didn't matter that they were young. You know, they had Milan Mihalik on their team to start the year. And after five games, they tossed him aside because they saw that Connor Brown, you know, was ready to play higher in the lineup, was ready to play, you know, on their matchup line with Kadri and Komarov. So it's little things like that that Babcock was able to do in terms of getting results from a team that was just so young. They had, I think, five players with 30 points who were rookies. And then you go beyond just the rookies, and they got career years from some of their veterans. You know, he did a really good job right away when he got to Toronto and kind of finding a role for Kadri. You know, he was this guy who was looked at in Toronto as kind of a disappointment, which was unfair, but was the perception. And Babcock put him into a role where he would match up against the other team's top lines, and it fit Kadri perfectly. He had 32 goals during the regular season, 61 points, both career highs. So there's just lots of things that Babcock did with a really young team to get it into the playoffs and really exceed expectations.
Jonas Siegel, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're discussing the NHL playoffs with him. Game 2 of the Rangers-Senators goes this afternoon in Ottawa. Jonas will cover it for the CP.
Jonas, what's your take on the Blues-Predators series so far? Because it certainly wasn't getting the same amount of hype as the Capitals-Penguins series was getting prior to round 2.
Yeah, it's a weird series. Like, it's not the most appealing series, and yet you watch the games, and they're actually pretty fun. The pace has been fun. Last night was enjoyable to watch. And they're both kind of weird teams in some ways. You know, St. Louis really changed after they fired Ken Hitchcock. And the biggest change for them was in goal. You know, Jake Allen went from being basically the worst goalie in the league, you know, before February 1st to the best goalie in the league after February 1st. And, you know, whether that was some changes with Martin Brodeur, who's, you know, assumed kind of a goalie coach role with the Blues, whether that's finding some confidence, whether that's differences in the way the team plays, they're giving up more shots. I don't know, but the Blues kind of became this team, you know, that really heated up down the stretch and now are giving a threat to a Predators team that we kind of look at as sneaky dark horse cup contenders. So it's a fun series. You know, I look at Nashville and you look at their defense and you look at all that they get from those top two pairs. You look at the way Pekka Rinne's played so far in these playoffs. That's been a surprise. So I think this could go either way. I think when I was doing picks, I initially had the Predators in six. And then at the last moment, I just said, you know what, Jake Allen, he's not going to stop playing like Martin Brodeur. I'll pick the Blues in six. And I honestly have no idea which way the series will ultimately
That's some good hedging there, Jonas. You can't be wrong if you pick both series, right?
I have no idea.
Jonas Siegel of the Canadian Press joins us from Ottawa. He's going to cover this afternoon's Rangers-Senators game 2. Jonas, thanks for doing this morning. I always appreciate your time, buddy.
Anytime. Thanks, boys.
All righty, Jonas. Take care. When we come back, we talk about that Blues-Predators series. It's tied up at 1 apiece after the Blues come back to beat the Predators last night. That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Now you're on the curve on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Remaining. Here comes Jaden Schwartz. Schwartz dropping it off. Tarasenko scores!
Schwartz is going to put it cross ice right here and then wants the play from Edmondson skate to the waiting Tarasenko, and he just rips that by Pekka Rinne.
Proves to be the game-winning goal. The St. Louis Blues tie their series against the Nashville Predators on the strength of that goal by Vladimir Tarasenko. He had two last night. That one came with 3 minutes and 51 seconds to go. That series tied up at one game apiece between the Blues and the Predators. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. I tell you what, I want to give credit to the Blues fans before we get into the nuts and bolts of the series. That was a raucous environment last night in St. Louis. A great atmosphere. It's going to be, I think, just as insane in Nashville when that series returns there tomorrow afternoon for Game 3. But that was a huge win for the Blues after they lost Game 1. They come back. Vladimir Tarasenko, he's the best player on the Blues. He leads them last night with those two goals, including that game winner. He tied the game in the first period on a power play goal. He wins the game in the third period with that fortuitous bounce right on his stick. And Tarasenko and his quick release make no mistake, giving the Blues the 3-2 win.
Well, starting off with the fans, Drew, I mean, we know that St. Louis sports fans in general are great fans, right? I got the opportunity on the way to your wedding in Kentucky to check out a Cardinals game in St. Louis. And, I mean, the atmosphere is incredible. And the Cardinals have had a lot of success, just like the St. Louis Blues have. And, you know, the Blues are in the playoffs year after year, guys. And this team went to the conference finals last year, lost to the San Jose Sharks. And, you know, you forget about that when you consider that the Blues were in danger of missing the playoffs this year. And that's what is so fascinating about this series. You've got the third and fourth place teams in the Central Division, because obviously the top two teams are out right now. These two teams beat the Chicago Blackhawks and the Minnesota Wild. So you kind of consider the St. Louis Blues and Nashville Predators to kind of be these dark horse, underdog, low-seed teams, which they obviously were low-seeded teams. But we expected these teams to be here this time of year, especially when you consider the Predators made the big trade to acquire P.K. Subban for Shea Weber, adding a more of an element of speed and skill, right? Shea Weber being more of kind of that stay-at-home defenseman with that big blast from the point. But, I mean, for me, this series is just as fascinating as the Penguins and Capitals series. And I wouldn't say that maybe this is the best series, but you look at the first couple of games, right? Nashville was the better team in game one. And last night, I mean, it looked like it was going to overtime. Drew, Tarasenko scores with less than 4 minutes. But for me, the Blues coming back from two deficits, right? They were down 1-0 and 2-1. And you know, for me, Alex Pietrangelo just continues to impress me. And I've always been a huge fan of Alex Pietrangelo's game. And how can you not be? I mean, the guy plays, you know, 22, 23-plus minutes every night. And I thought he was excellent yesterday. But, I mean, the story really was Vladimir Tarasenko. We've talked about it over the years. I mean, the Blues have needed that game-breaker. And the more I watch Vladimir Tarasenko, he reminds me of Pavel Bure. And he's a different type of player. But the natural skill and speed that Tarasenko has is just incredible. And you know, when you talk about the Hart Trophy and the Art Ross race and everything like that, Vladimir Tarasenko doesn't come up very often, but I mean, he's right up there as far as I'm concerned with the skilled players. And yesterday, that was a game where Tarasenko needed to step up, and he did.
Well, there's only so many players in the league when you're watching them, especially live, you know, because we see the Blues through MTS Center all the time. When a guy has the puck on his stick And he's got a little bit of space, and he enters the blue, and he enters the offensive zone. There's very few players in the league you sort of hold your breath and say this is a bad situation just by default. And Tarasenko is one of those guys.
He's got just as good of a release and shot as Ovechkin, as far as I'm concerned. And you saw what happened in Game One between the Penguins and Capitals. The Penguins gave Alex Ovechkin too much room on his goal, and he walks in and he beats Marc-Andre Fleury. So for me, this series has been such a fun series to watch. And for me, I mean, I had this series going to six or seven games. I do think the Blues are going to take it, but I had a lot of trouble not picking the Predators, because when you beat the Chicago Blackhawks, a Stanley Cup favorite, in four games, I mean, it's really hard not to go with the Predators, and they have so many good storylines. But, you know, Ryan Ellis is a guy, to me, picks up a goal and an assist. When you talk about the Predators' defense, you think of P.K. Subban, Roman Josi, Matthias Ekholm. Ryan Ellis is kind of that fourth defenseman in their top four that you don't think about a lot, but he is a fantastic defenseman, Dave.
No, he was unbelievable yesterday, and he made some plays, and Petrangelo made a bit of an error on that first goal that Ellis took the shot on because he was on his wrong side, and he tried to clear the puck out of the zone, and he didn't, and then Ellis kept it in, and he made a beautiful shot that eventually I think James Neal got credit for.
That's right.
That was tipped in, and it's interesting because it had been all St. Louis to that point. The first 8 minutes was all St. Louis. I don't even think Nashville had a shot on net. That was either their first or second shot on net that they scored on. So, you know, it was a credit to Ryan Ellis. He's a really good defenseman. And you're right, Ez. Like, you just don't really take him for – you take him for granted because of the rest of the Nashville defense. But he really is just such a rock there. And, you know, to me, the penalty on Vern Fiddler, I didn't think it was a five-minute worthy penalty. I didn't think it was worth a major. I thought it was clear if you watched, they slowed it down. I mean, and again, this hockey is a very fast game, so I get how the refs saw it. They saw Barreco down, and they thought to themselves, okay, well, it was clearly a knee-on-knee. You know, it's hard to judge intent, and they see that he's down. And then the play, you know, gets whistled, and okay, fine, they called it. My problem is, you know, and again, this is hindsight, but when you watch the replay, clearly Fiddler has his eyes on Barreco. Barreco moves out of the way, and Fiddler catches him. It's unfortunate, but I mean, like I said, he tried to, you know, rise up. From my perspective, it was a 2-minute penalty. That one could have really killed the game for Nashville. It didn't in the end. It only resulted in one power play goal against, which was the Tarasenko one.
Yeah, but, the first Tarasenko goal.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, in that second period, Vernon Fiddler's penalty, they had 3.5 minutes left on that power play. And then Ryan Johansson also took a penalty there in the second period. So basically a quarter of the second period, the St. Louis Blues were on the power play. And then in the third period, the Predators took another 2 penalties. So you had the Predators taking 5 penalties, and the Blues didn't take a single penalty, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was a big portion of the game was a power play for the St. Louis Blues, right? And, you know, like you said, they only scored the one goal, but that was a key goal. And they overcame those two deficits and scored that late goal from Tarasenko. And he really was the difference. But again, you know, give Jake Allen a lot of credit. He still made 31 saves. He's been excellent all throughout the playoffs.
15 saves in the third period. I mean, the Predators outshot the Blues 15-6 in the third period. And especially after Tarasenko scored to give the Predators the lead, Jake Allen was spectacular for the last, you know, 4 minutes of that game as the Predators just poured the shots on the Blues net.
And speaking of that goal, and it's an interesting point that Scotty Upshaw made in the first period intermission. He talked about how there's more room in the neutral zone than there was in the Minnesota series. He talked about how Minnesota managed to bog them down and not really give them that opportunity to kind of take that puck up through the neutral zone and establish themselves in the offensive zone, whereas they were having more of an opportunity with Nashville, which is interesting because of Nashville's defense. You think that wouldn't be as likely, but in fact it was, and you saw it on that goal. Schwartz carries that puck in, and you know, it's funny, he passed it over. Edmondson actually skillfully used his foot to kind of direct it towards Tarasenko, recognizing that Tarasenko was right there, and then of course Tarasenko's release was incredible, and the pressure that Nashville put forward, I don't know how they didn't score. You're right, Allen was phenomenal in those final minutes of the game as Nashville was pushing to send it into overtime. They obviously wanted to see an ICOT pool.
Yeah, haven't had one in the second round yet.
Exactly. As many as we've had in the first round, there wasn't any 18 in the second. So clearly, you know, Allen had to be on top of his game, and we saw him do just that. It was kind of similar to what the flurry of shots that Marc-Andre Fleury stopped in that segment against Washington, and he was excellent to close out the game.
Sorry, I was just checking, Dave. Jake Allen actually made 22 saves, but 15 of those were in the third period. I didn't realize that the Predators only had 24 shots. I thought it was around 34 for some reason.
No,
I
mean, it was actually a low in terms of shots on goal, it wasn't a big number, except for the third period. I mean, I think the first period was, 6-4 shots
on
goal?
Yeah, like I said, it was almost all St. Louis initially.
Yeah.
The first 8 minutes, it was mostly St. Louis.
Do we want to touch on at all Mike Milbury's comments about PK Subban?
I don't think it's merits a comment. I mean,
so we agree that if there's anybody that's a clown in this, it's not PK Subban, it's Mike Milbury?
If you can't enjoy playing hockey, I'm sorry. Like, PK Subban is beyond reproach in my mind. You can't talk about PK Subban in any negative light. That's not true. If he does something negative, then it merits conversation. But I'm sorry, him having fun in pregame is ridiculous to argue with.
When we come back, Andy Strickland of Fox Sports Midwest joins us to talk about the Blues and the Predators series. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're on the curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. You can contribute to the show by following us on Twitter, where you can send us praise and or hate. Preferably praise. We get enough hate from one another in the room. In fact, we're fueled by hate.
Yes, that's true.
It's one of our unknown slogans is Illegal Curve, fueled by hate of one another.
Well, that was our team name in the fantasy football draft that we go in every year. And then
you guys haven't been in it for the last couple of years, though.
That's right. Once we realized we were drafting players who were no longer in the league, I realized, aside from our first year of luck, where we got most points and we had like the number one. Somehow we had the number one.
The beginner's luck for the first year.
Yeah, we were pretty good waiver wire pickers at that point.
Yeah, we had a lot of Falcons that year. I remember we had Matt Ryan and we had Julio Jones and Roddy White.
Yeah,
it was all downhill from
and Gonzalez as well. We had and the kicker. What's his name? Was it Bryant at that point?
It was Atlanta's kicker?
Yeah.
Matt Bryant.
Yeah. So I think we had Matt Bryant. I think we had five Falcons.
Hold on, Matt Ryan wasn't the quarterback.
Yes, he was.
So they have Matt Ryan and Matt Bryant.
That's correct.
And we're the guys who somehow finished first and had most of the points.
Indeed. Anyways, moving on from that phenomenon. Anyways, you can, as I was saying, you can follow us on Twitter. Facebook.com/IllegalCurve is our Facebook page. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program Andy Strickland. Andy is the rinkside reporter for the St. Louis Blues on Fox Sports Midwest. The Blues and the Predators tied at one game apiece. Game three goes tomorrow afternoon back in Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Andy, good morning and thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it. Good to be here. How are you guys?
Very well, Andy. Thanks for doing this. I'm sure it's a busy time for you as you cover this series. A fun couple games to start the series. Last night's game two, also tremendously fun. The Predators jump out to the early lead, and then Vladimir Tarasenko, he's the best player on the St. Louis Blues, at least the best offensive player, and he proves it last night getting those two goals, including the game winner with about 4 minutes to go. A best player doing the best, what he needs to do, be the best player on the ice come game two of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yeah, well, P.K. Subban said after game one, that's what they pay me to do. Well, this is what they pay Vladimir Tarasenko to do. This guy is a true, legitimate game-breaker in the National Hockey League, and that's his role on this hockey club. That's why he's so dangerous. And he obviously hasn't scored a whole lot thus far here in the playoffs. He had one goal in the previous round against Minnesota. But, you know, and it may sound foolish to some, but the reality is the coaching staff's been happy with the way he's been playing just in terms of his all-around game. Now, we all know that they need him to score at the end of the day. You know, you're trying to advance in the playoffs. You can get some production out of some other players, but, you know, advancing in the playoffs without your best players being your best players is difficult to do, even though sometimes they cancel each other out. But you're right, they were able to come back and win that game yesterday. That's kind of been a tone for the Blues here in the playoffs, their ability to respond, deal with adversity. Whenever they're down in the game, they still find a way to come back and tie the game. And even in the previous round, they got shut out in game four, went to game five on the road and closed it out against Minnesota. So they continue to show that resiliency. And yesterday was obviously a huge game to even up the series.
Andy, Vladimir Sobotka is such an interesting player to me. He joins the Blues late in the season from the Continental Hockey League. He has the previous history with the St. Louis Blues. He's 29 years old now. He plays one regular season game, and he scored a big goal in game one. He's got two goals and 4 points in seven games now. Just how impressed have you been with Sobotka and his ability to basically enter this Blues lineup seamlessly?
Well, if you go back to the last game of the regular season, he scored a goal. That was the only game that he played in the regular season for the Blues. And I don't think a whole lot of people knew what to expect from him. You know, coming over from the KHL, he had a couple of injuries that he dealt with over there, although this season he's been relatively healthy. He played in all the playoff games for his KHL team over in Russia as well. And I think he's gotten better and better as the playoffs have progressed. You know, before he left, you know, he was known for his, you know, willingness and ability to get in the face of the opposition, to play that hard, grinded-out game, that sandpaper game. And I still think he has that, even though he hasn't shown a ton of it thus far here in the playoffs. But, you know, going over to the KHL, his role changed a little bit. I mean, he played with good players over here, but over there he was, you know, expected to score. He was put in scoring situations every single game, playing first-unit power plays, playing top-line minutes. And, you know, it's a different game over there as well. He spent a lot more time with the puck, focusing on making plays. So I think his mindset as a player changed a little bit. And you can see that ability to make plays and that creativeness and maybe the skill level being increased since he's come back from the KHL. I think after spending the last 3 years playing the role that he played in over there. So it's been pretty impressive. You know, last night he had that horrible giveaway on Ryan Ellis's go-ahead goal in the third period. Not exactly sure what he was thinking, you know, what he was seeing in that situation, you know, trying to force the puck to the middle of the ice. But, you know, he's a guy who can make up for it later in the game and does so many things well. He's always been a Swiss Army knife of a player. You can slide him up and down your lineup. He can play with anybody. He can kill penalties. He can play the power play. He can play with third-line checkers. He can play with first-line offensive weapons. I mean, he's a luxury to bring to your lineup, especially this time of year.
Andy, Scotty Upshaw in the first intermission talked about the neutral zone against Nashville versus the neutral zone in Minnesota and how the Wild clogged it up a lot more than Nashville has, and it's allowed St. Louis to kind of have a better pace. Have you noticed that in this series?
Yeah, and you wouldn't have thought so. You know, Nashville plays that 1-3-1, that right left-wing lock, whatever you want to call it, and, you know, they really stifled Chicago in the previous round. And, you know, I said this prior to the series, guys, is, you know, the old saying, you got to be able to give it up to get it back. You're going to have to, you know, chip pucks in deep, get it behind their D, force them to turn, and really get after it and forecheck, you know, get on the forecheck and get the puck back, you know, from playing that style of hockey. And Chicago wasn't willing to do that. You know, it's really not in the DNA of guys like Kane and Panarin and some of those guys. You know, they want to carry the puck through the neutral zone. They want to enter the puck or enter the zone with the puck offensively. And you got to be willing to punt every once in a while when the play's not there and get pucks in deep. And I think it's a little more natural for the Blues to play that way. They don't you know, have the same type of skill maybe that Chicago has, even though they have skilled players. But their skilled players are willing to play the style of hockey you have to be able to play if you want to win against these type of teams who do clog up the neutral zone. I thought it was difficult for the Blues in Game 1 early in the game to get to the neutral zone. Because of the way that they play. But, you know, when you have guys like Schwartz and Tarasenko and Stastny and Steen, you know, some of your top offensive players who are willing to get pucks in deep and truly forecheck, you know, it makes life a little bit easier, and obviously that rubs off on the rest of the roster as well. So maybe it has been a little bit easier. I think the Blues have done a great job in terms of how they've adjusted to allow them to transition the puck at a pretty high level. And obviously, it's made them successful. They've spent a lot of the zone, the game thus far here in the first two games in their zone.
Andy Strickland, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Andy covers the St. Louis Blues for Fox Sports Midwest. Andy, we have to talk about Jake Allen. This is a guy who has gone certainly through the ups and downs in the course of this season, from being left at home on the road trip. He started here in Winnipeg, where the Blues chose to give him a mental break, to all of a sudden being, I mean, if not the story of the playoffs, then one of the stories of the playoffs. When Jake Allen was at his peak struggles during the course of this season, did you see a turnaround of this extent as realistic?
Well, of course not. I mean, nobody saw this happening. I mean, I didn't see a turnaround for the team like this. You know, to see the team be the best team in the National Hockey League over the course of the last, you know, month and a half, 2 months of the season, which is what they were since Mike Yeo took over. You know, and obviously he was a huge part of it. You know, I don't think a lot of people gave him the necessary credit that he probably deserved, because the Blues were playing a lot of teams down the stretch that were sitting outside of the playoff picture, but they beat some pretty good teams down the stretch as well who were, you know, considered Stanley Cup contenders, like Anaheim, for example. They beat San Jose. They beat Pittsburgh. I mean, they were beating some pretty good teams in addition to the Arizonas and the Colorados, playing Winnipeg on a couple of occasions. But Winnipeg, obviously, is, if for whatever reason you guys, they beat Chicago and St. Louis all the time, but can't beat anybody else. It's crazy. But, you know, Jake Allen is a guy who, this is the path the Blues believed that he would be on years ago. You know, he was the best goaltender in the Canadian Hockey League, playing in the Quebec League. He was the best goaltender in the American Hockey League. He led the AHL in all the important goaltender statistical categories, wins, shutouts, goals against average, save percentage. He was an all-star in the American Hockey League as a rookie. So he's been on this path. And, you know, even last season, you know, it was kind of the Brian Elliott show the second half, and obviously Elliott started the playoffs as the goaltender for the Blues. You know, Brian Elliott Jake Allen, you could make the case, was the MVP of the team prior to him going down with injury in January. And if he didn't suffer that injury, he probably would have been the guy, you know, down the stretch last season as well. You know, and I'll play a little devil's advocate. A lot of people are like, wow, you know, how could the Blues leave him home? You know, maybe that was good for him. You never know. I mean, he was dealing with a life change off the ice. He had a baby. You know, that certainly is an adjustment, especially during the course of the season. And we all know how much, you know, the mental part of the game, you know, makes up the goaltending position. And it just wasn't there. And he wasn't playing well. You know, I mean, that's the one thing that you can't beat around the bush there either. You know, Jake Allen wasn't playing good hockey, you know, and giving credit, he was able to turn things around. Now, Martin Brodeur has a lot to do with that, I think. You know, he was, you know, took over as the goaltending coach when Mike Yeo took over. Jimmy Corsi had been here the last few years, and, you know, he was fired along with Ken Hitchcock. And you know, one thing that Martin Brodeur did, I mean, he's been on the ice with him every day. I mean, between games, morning skates. And, you know, they just kind of speak the same language. I think he's helped him with the mental part of the game, you know, teaching him how to move on after a bad goal, after a bad game. You've got to be able to turn the page and have a short memory. So I think, you know, there's been some technical stuff that maybe they've gone over for sure. But, you know, Martin Brodeur didn't play the position like a lot of other goaltenders. So it's going to be difficult for, you know, maybe from a technical standpoint, for him to teach goaltenders to play the way that he played. And that's not what he was trying to do. But I think mentally, he understands what it takes to win and what it takes to be focused. And I think he shared a lot of that with Jake Allen. Plus, you know, he goes into the locker room. They discuss a lot of things between periods. They discuss tendencies the opposing team may be trying to do, what individual shooters may be trying to do. You know, having that communication between periods is new to Jake Allen, but there's no question Martin Brodeur has had a huge impact on the play of not only Jake Allen, but also Carter Hutton, who had some big victories for this hockey club down the stretch.
Andy, Alex Pietrangelo's only got 2 assists in 7 games, but there are only 2 more players in the entire NHL that have played more than him so far in the playoffs. He's averaging 28 minutes and 49 seconds. Erik Karlsson is number 1 at 30 minutes and 11 seconds. Is this maybe the best you've ever seen Alex Pietrangelo play defensively?
You know, I'm not sure. I've seen him play some great hockey in the Olympics, and I've seen him play great hockey in the playoffs in the past. You know, to be honest with you, his game the last couple here in this series against Nashville probably hasn't been as strong as what we saw in the first round against Minnesota. Not that he's playing bad hockey by any means, but I think he was a -2 last game. I think he was a -2 in the first game as well. So there's another level now for Pietrangelo to get to here in this series, just like we saw in the first round against the Minnesota Wild. So, you know, I'm a big believer in the way the game is played nowadays, guys. I mean, I know we celebrate guys like Karlsson and Doughty, to an extent, Pietrangelo, Dustin Byfuglien there in Winnipeg. These guys have played just an incredible amount of minutes. I don't think you really need to play a defenseman that much, to be honest with you. Ryan Suter is another one in Minnesota. With as good as these players are nowadays, you have 6 defensemen that can eat up minutes. And the days of having to have a guy play 29, 30 minutes a game, even 28 minutes a game, and, you know, obviously his average is reflected by a couple of overtime games there for the first round. I just don't think you need it. I mean, you've got guys who are your 5th and 6th defensemen who can play the game nowadays, where in the past maybe you didn't have that luxury. Not that they're going to go out there and play 20 minutes, but they can give you somewhere between 11 and 15 minutes on any given night and really relieve the pressure off some of these top guys. To me, it's just my opinion, the days of having to play a guy 28, 29 minutes a game are unnecessary, and it can wear a guy down. And this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And if the Blues are able to accomplish what they want to accomplish, which is obviously winning a Stanley Cup, they're going to have to play for another, you know, 4 or 5 weeks here, and you're going to have to manage the ice time of your best players because it's only natural. It's human nature. They're going to wear down. You can't play 29, 30 minutes a game every other night and expect to perform at a superhuman level every game.
Andy, one of the plays that turned the game around in terms of goal scoring was the 5-minute major that Vernon Fiddler was assessed for his hit on Colton Parayko. How did you see that hit?
Well, I didn't really like it. You know, I mean, listen, these guys are so good. They know what they're doing, even though it's a fast game and, you know, things happen quickly out there. It looked like he stuck his leg out a little bit, and it's a dangerous play. You know, whenever you have one of these knee-on-knee collisions in that situation, I think you have to act appropriately, and I think that's what the, you know, officials did in that situation. Did he deserve a game misconduct in the 5-minute major? I mean, certainly that's up for debate. But, you know, watching the play live, and that's the luxury, the only luxury the officials are afforded. They see it one time, they see it live. And, you know, they got to make a judgment call pretty quickly. But in that type of situation, I don't like those knee-on-knee hits. I didn't have a problem with the call.
Andy Strickland is covering the Blues and the Predators for Fox Sports Midwest. Andy, appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Okay, anytime, guys. Enjoy the playoffs. Take care.
Take care, Andy. Thanks again. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll touch on the Capitals and the Penguins. They have Game 2, which goes tonight. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
On the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Seven and a half to go. Third period, tie game. Scott Wilson ahead. He got it on to Bonino. He scores! The backbreaker of Game 6 last spring has broken the tie in the third period.
I ask you, gentlemen, who's better than Doc Emrick?
Well, you know how many years I watched Doc Emrick call the New Jersey Devils games for MSG, right?
So, I do.
As far as I'm concerned, he's one of the best.
That was the call from Game 1 where Nick Bonino scores late in the third period to give the Penguins a 3-2 victory over the Capitals. He scored with 7:24 to play in the third period after Sidney Crosby had scored twice in the first minute and 4 seconds of the second period to give the Penguins a 2-0 lead. The Capitals battle back to tie it up at 2 goals apiece before Bonino goes in, sent in all alone. It wasn't a bad line change, just sort of way too much space between the defensemen there. Brooks Orpik late getting over, and Bonino is able to capitalize and give the Penguins that 3-2 lead, which turns into be a 3-2 victory. Game 2 of the Penguins and the Capitals goes tonight at 7 o'clock Winnipeg time. This is, I mean, to me, this might be the Stanley Cup final.
Yeah, and you know, I had a bunch of people over watching Game 1 on Thursday
night.
Okay,
neither.
Did you get an invite, Dave?
I did not.
I didn't get an invite either.
I was waiting for an invite. Actually,
I saw that there was a gathering.
I checked my email. I checked my my mailbox outside. There was no invite forthcoming.
No Instagram DM. No Twitter DM.
I actually sent. Did you see? I sent a carrier pigeon.
Yeah.
To you, Dave, and that's
unfortunately got eaten by a hawk.
Yeah. No, he ate the carrier pigeon. He was getting ready to send it.
You know what, I don't invite you. I mean, you're married. You have a kid. You have a second one on the way. I don't really include you in any social events aside from the radio show.
Thank you.
So don't expect any invites in the future. You're lucky that you got an invite to the wedding. As far as Dave is concerned,
go to your bachelor party.
Well, yeah, we'll throw that in there too. I mean, I need somebody to look after me. That's and make true. Sure I don't pass out on the golf course, right?
Just pass out everywhere. Pass out the golf course. At least you won't drown. If you pass out into the lake, that'll be the more concerning issue.
In all seriousness, though, that Game 1 had everything, right? You had two goals.
I thought he was going to say, in all seriousness, I might pass out into the lake.
Well, I'm definitely going to pass out, but hopefully it's in the bedroom.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have Sidney Crosby scoring two goals there in just over a minute, or pardon me, it was actually less than a minute, and you had some excellent goaltending, especially from Marc-Andre Fleury in the final stages of that third period. He made 6 saves there late in the game, and it looked like Washington was going to tie that game up and send it to overtime, and that's what the Capitals do, right? They go to overtime in the playoffs, apparently. But, you know, Nick Bonino, he was the hero last year, Drew, in Game 6 against the Washington Capitals. And, you know, Pittsburgh manages to now steal home ice advantage. And, mm-hmm. you know, you win Game 1, and that's crucial. And I thought it was very impressive. You know, the Washington Capitals, give them credit. I mean, they tied this game up. You know, Alex Ovechkin has way too much room, and he moves in and beats Marc-Andre Fleury with a beautiful shot. And then Evgeny Kuznetsov ties it up there midway through the third period. And as far as I'm concerned, Kuznetsov has got to stop with that Coco Beware dance. I mean, he's done it twice now, and the Capitals have lost both games. I mean, you've tied the game up. Just go back out there and score the winning goal instead of celebrating before you actually have the lead. You shouldn't be celebrating, as far as I'm concerned, when the game's tied.
So, but you're okay with PK Subban pregame celebrating?
Oh, I have no problem with that.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
I'm also a big PK Subban fan and not the biggest fan of Evgeny Kuznetsov, so maybe that's part of it. But sure.
I can understand differentiating between doing it during the game and different versus before the game. I can listen to that argument.
And Grapes has talked about it, right?
I mean, what Grapes says.
Well, I mean, I think he's right a lot of the time, and I think players on the other team see that, and that fires them up. So I think you look stupid when you do that and you lose. That's all I'm saying.
Fair enough. I can listen to that. But so Dave, game two between the Penguins and the Capitals tonight. You know, we had Jonas Siegel on earlier, and I think it was you who asked him about what Washington can learn and what they can take away from the series versus the Toronto Maple Leafs. A hard-fought six-game victory, whereas the Penguins sort of had a much easier way of rolling through the Blue Jackets in five. Do you think this Capitals team, having now lost home ice advantage, having lost game one to the Leafs, do you think that they're going to play a little tighter, or do you think that they're a more mature version of their team and losing one game won't affect them as much as it may have in previous years?
Yeah, I think it's the latter for sure. I don't think that this is a team that's going to wilt under the pressure. I mean, obviously you're going up against the defending Stanley Cup champion, and you know Pittsburgh isn't exactly going to wilt under any pressure as well. So you're really having a test of two giants going up against each other. But you know, make no mistake, Washington didn't play their best game. They played a good game, but they didn't play their best game. So I think this is a Washington team we're going to see today that I expect them to win. I think this series is going the full seven, and I would be shocked if Washington somehow played a tight game. Like, I just think, I mean, obviously if Pittsburgh gets a first goal, you know, or second, you know, they take a 2-0 lead, then Drew, that could come true. But I really don't anticipate that. I really think that, you know, you're going to see a Washington team come out. Backstrom was, you know, probably one of the best players in that last series for the Capitals, and he can take it to another level. And you know, Holtby, I mean, we've been talking about Holtby, you know, for how many years now as such an incredible goaltender. So, you know,
does he need to be better? Does Braden Holtby need to be better? Does he need to outplay Marc-Andre Fleury for the Capitals to win this series?
I think part of the problem is it was defensive breakdowns, right? Like, it's not, and I mean, the fact is that Crosby's goal, you know, on a one-time shot, that first one, that was a pretty spectacular one. Then the second one, Hornquist makes a beautiful play to get it over to Crosby. I mean, and that's the thing. We saw it with Joel Edmondson when he kind of kicked it over to Tarasenko on that goal. Some of the plays guys are making now, just not like getting a puck and turning and trying and firing it, but actually seeing, okay, there's a guy like Crosby who's right beside me. If I just get it to him, a little touch pass or a kick with my foot, and I get it over to him. So there's a lot of heads-up plays. So, you know, to be honest with you, like, it's very hard for to blame Holtby on either of those two, because, like I said, one's a two-on-one with Sidney Crosby, best player in the NHL. It's very hard to say, okay, well, you know, you're not a slouch if you can't stop the best player.
Sure.
And secondly, the other one was just like a defensive breakdown where, you know, you've got everybody covered and Crosby's coming in kind of on his own, and Hornquist gets him the puck.
And it looks like Barry Trotz is going to stick with having Backstrom, Ovechkin, and Oshie up against Crosby's line. And I agree with Dave. I mean, these games often do come down to one goal, right? And that first goal, I mean, Matt Niskanen's caught there in the neutral zone, and Orlov's stuck there on a two-on-one with Gensel and Crosby. Gensel makes a beautiful pass. But they can be better defensively, and you know, let's be honest, I mean, they didn't have the best start in that first period. It was a feeling out period, right? I think you only had 9 shots total in that first period. But the Washington Capitals, again, they're going to basically have to play mistake-free hockey. The Penguins are just too skilled, too quick. They've got to be better, but I agree. I mean, this series is just beginning, and hopefully we're going to have a classic seven-gamer.
It really would be. I mean, every game that these two teams play against each other, it's a treat for hockey fans, and it's amazing that the Penguins are doing this without Matt Murray and without Chris Letang in their lineup. Game two of the Capitals and Penguins goes later on tonight. Let's go to break. We're expecting a call from Vegas Golden Knights assistant general manager Kelly McCrimmon. He's supposed to join us next segment, so hopefully we'll hear from Kelly coming up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.